Blog Talk Radio.
Coming soon, the Movie Geeks continue the Kubrick series with Episode 2, an in-depth exploration of the mysteries of 2001, A Space Odyssey, with nearly two dozen special guests.
Definitely has a spiritual dimension to 2001. Mm-hmm. In fact, Hal, if you switch the letters around, you get A-L-H, which you know is in Allah, and it's also the three primary consonants in the Hebrew word Elohim, which is the standard word for God in the Old Testament. But it's Hal is not A-L-H. Hal is that twisted up, right? And again, you look at the one eye of Hal, and you connect it with the eye of the pyramid, which is supposed to represent God and the dollar bill. And again, these connections are there. The question is, you know, what does it really mean? And I don't know, but I know that Hal is definitely the demonic side of all of this. The red eye, right?
The Kubrick series, episode 2, The Ultimate Trip, coming later this month on Movie Geeks United. For more information, go to moviegeeksunited.net/Kubrick. United is back on the air. We've been gone, 17 days, Jerry?
Yeah, we've been gone 17 days, but we had probably one of the greatest shows of all time last Sunday, so. But we have been gone. We have been. And also the Matthew Modine show on Friday, so.
Right. Yeah, we took some time off so we could complete that first episode of Kubrick. So this is our first, you know, the kind
Live.
Of show that we're accustomed to putting on.
Right.
In 17 days, have you missed it?
Oh, yeah. I have. I honestly have. So,
as you said, there's a special sneak peek of the remaining episodes in our Kubrick series. In an episode that you guys aren't going to get until February, the Full Metal Jacket show, we have the uncut interview with Matthew Modine up there right now. On our website, both here at Blog Talk Radio and at MovieGeeksUnited.net. If you go to Kubrick Series Uncut, it'll list that interview of Mr. Modine and James B. Harris. But the interview with Mr. Modine, we posted it early because he has a new Full Metal Jacket project that he just unveiled to the world Friday. And it's a new iPad application from his Full Metal Jacket Diary, which is completely interactive. It has input from other people involved in the film as well. It's a whole new experience and a whole new way to experience both Kubrick and this particular film.
What would Kubrick have made of all this?
I think he would have really liked it as much as he was advanced in terms of technology and its possibilities, and also Matthew has some beautiful black and white photography, some stills that he took from the actual set that you can purchase there at his site too. FullMetalJacketDiary.com, and you can also befriend them on Twitter and Facebook. You like the way I said that? Twitter. These kids and their Twitter. So that's some exciting news. Jerry, how you been?
I've been good. How are you?
I'm fine.
You're doing well. No, we're all, I think, hanging in there. No, it's a Kubrick Fiesta with a Aronofsky break tonight.
Mm-hmm. And they, you know, Aronofsky has expressed his admiration of Kubrick too.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
It's all tied together, man.
Oh, it is. It's all tied together. It's Stanley Kubrick's world. We're just living in it.
And I also had a conversation this weekend about the Coen brothers and how they're very respectful of Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
And they see their career in making films as their each project as a way of grappling at their reaction to Kubrick's work and deciphering it for themselves.
Wow.
And I bring that up because I watch True Grit tomorrow night, so I'll be able to report.
Yeah, I'll be very curious how True Grit ties into Kubrick. That's fascinating.
I don't know. You know what? But for the first time, I'll sit down and watch a Coen Brothers movie with that in mind. With that mind.
I know. I've never would have thought that, but okay, cool. All right, whatever.
Another connection, Jeff Bridges just picked up that Stanley Kubrick Award
mm-hmm.
a couple of weeks ago, and he's in True Grit. You cannot
right.
escape it.
You can't yeah. escape the connections.
6 degrees of Stanley Kubrick. That's the game. We should play that game. We've never played that game here on the
show. That would be a very good game to play.
I think that's a good idea.
That yeah. is. It's a very good idea.
So as a means of introducing this first guest, we have a great lineup of movie talk tonight, and we have two guests that we're going to share with you guys as well. As a means of introducing this first guest, you saw the movie that she's in
mm-hmm.
this weekend, this past week.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about Black Swan.
It's wild. I will say that. The reviews have not been the ecstatic ones you would expect. I think it was compared it to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I don't think it's that. It's insane, though, but it's classic Aronofsky, because it is, it's all about, like, you know, in the sense that it is a constant motif in Aronofsky's work, even The Wrestler, about body mutilation and that sort of thing, the damage we do to the body in order to seek this kind of perfection. And that's what the movie's about from Natalie Portman's perspective, about giving this perfect performance. And she's fantastic in it. Everyone is fantastic in it. I would think up and down, everyone's worthy of some sort of nomination. But everyone sort of has these, like, crazed personalities. Winona Ryder's character, Barbara Hershey as Natalie Portman's mother, Mila Kunis, the transitional role from Valley Girl into something else. She's incredible in this movie, as is Natalie Portman, but it's really her show. But this is just a fantastic film. I like it. There's a lot of people say it's very trashy, and yes, it is, but it's what he does with those exploitations and those cliches and what he does with them to really make quite a lasting impact. And Vincent Cassel, you cannot write him off. This has been his year. Between this and the French gangster epic, Mesrine, he's just been incredible.
By Christmas, it's going to open wide. I mean, that was the announcement the other day.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be wide by the Christmas holiday.
Okay, cool.
But my impression, it seems to be a very, and I love Aronofsky like you do, it seems
mm-hmm.
to be a delirious, lurid.
That's the word, delirious.
Yeah.
You can't take your eyes off it.
Does it feel like De Palma in some way?
Somewhat. I wasn't really... let me put it to you like this. It ain't the Red Shoes. Okay, let's get that out of the way.
It's Aronofsky's Red Shoes, and the red is
maybe,
blood.
Maybe,
probably,
but
right?
It ain't the Red Shoes. But and it's not Turning Point either. But when we walked out, my mom said something very interesting. Oh, it reminded me a lot of an Italian horror movie. And, you know,
right.
one of the great Italian, the Dario Argento film... Yeah, it definitely has that feel.
I love that about him. I love that go for broke quality
mm-hmm.
about Aronofsky. You know,
yeah, it did very well this weekend, and it was only in 90 theaters, but it did incredibly well.
I think it holds the record for a limited release for that studio.
Yeah,
actually,
I think you're right. You know,
well, we're very pleased. Our first guest tonight plays a major role in Black
mm-hmm.
Swan, and this is a movie that I know so many people out there are very excited about, myself included. So we're very pleased to bring you Christina Annapau. She's terrific in the film, and she was terrific to talk to, just a delightful, delightful interview. And you can also check her out in Cruel Intentions 3. And Cursed, the Wes Craven film.
Oh, the one about the werewolves. Yeah, with Jesse Eisenberg's in that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And she has some very, very informative insights about Darren Aronofsky and the process from an actor's point of view of working with him and what he brings out in you as a performer. Here is Christina. Tell me about Aronofsky and his approach to actors. How does he communicate with you?
He communicates very clearly. I mean, he knows exactly what he wants from a scene, and I think he really pays close attention to who you are as a person and what, you know, what triggers you might have emotionally that are deeply personal to get the best response from you in that moment, in that scene. And as seen with his previous movies that have done so well and the actors that have given such great performances in them, I think this one is no different. And I really do attribute it to that, that he really, really observes the actor as an individual and pays attention to, you know, what he can do to help them drum up the most reality and, you know, the most authentic expression from their own experiences to suit the need of the character or of the scene and of the movie on a whole.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating to me is the dynamic between what we see on the screen and the final product and what you've experienced putting that together. And I'm curious because it's such a heightened film. It's operatic in a way. What was the atmosphere on the set?
It was absolutely an intense atmosphere, which is one thing that I really, really enjoyed about working with Darren. Is, you know, it's like, I don't know what to liken it to, but it's almost like, you know, life during wartime. Like, nobody can afford to mess up, and so everybody's just has to be 100% focused and 100% on at all times. And you never know, you know, his style of shooting. There's a lot of times there's cameras everywhere, if there's one camera, it's, you know, moving all over the place. So even if, you know, you might think, you know, you're not on, you have to be on all the time. And a lot of the scenes that I watched, there might just be like a moment or two of me in that scene. And I remember that, you know, the few days of intense work that went into that, and having to be 100% on or dancing, you know, 100% full out every single take. You know, and then to see the results, like, you know, part of that was a little bit disappointing sometimes to see, like, oh, my God, all that work. But that's just, you know, his shooting style. And there's something brilliant about that as far as just the process of actually, it's a very full process as far as the emoting and the expressing. And you know, you can't be lazy at all as an actor on one of his film sets, and you know he demands that even if the chances of you being seen in that take is so slim, you better be going full out because you know that's the take you can like cut to your face. You know,
uh-huh.
It's really
yeah.
It can be a bit stressful, but I think all of us really after a while really embrace that, and I really respect that, and I think it's why he gets such authentic, great performances out of his actors, and mm-hmm. why his movies have, you know, touched people so powerfully and have that sort of a kind of realism that a lot of, you know, as fanciful as they may be in certain moments or as operatic as they may be, they have this kind of realism that just reaches right into people's souls and touches them because, you know, he's bringing that out in every single moment, and he is 100% focused and 100% on every second
yeah.
when he's on set. I don't know. He's got the endurance of, you know, higher than anyone I've ever seen as far as his focus goes.
I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who was turned into a swan, but her prince falls for the wrong girl, and she kills herself. He promised to feature me more this season.
Well, he should. You've been there long enough. And you're the most dedicated dancer in the company.
Our new swan queen, the exquisite Nina Sayers.
Oh, Lily, you're going to be amazing.
Watch the way she moves. Sensual. She's not faking it.
Seduce us! Attack it! Attack it! Come on!
Where'd you get these?
It's nothing.
You sweet girl.
Feel my touch. Respond to it.
If someone's hot for teacher, I don't want to talk about that.
You really need to relax.
It's the role, isn't it? There's all this pressure. I knew it'd be too much. I knew it.
What's she doing here?
You made me your alternate.
The only person standing in your way is you.
Now, you come from the world of ballet, don't you?
Mm-hmm, I do. I've been dancing since I was 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
I do, yeah.
And tell me what, in this film, Black Swan, what truths does it tell about that world?
I think it gives a very accurate depiction of the professional ballet world and the competitiveness and the drive that the ballerinas have and the athleticism and the pain and, you know, physical ailments that go into something that when an audience goes to see a ballet looks so incredibly etheric and beautiful. And this film does a great job at going behind the scenes and showing not only physically all the turmoil that goes into creating something of such beauty, but the emotional turmoil and the competition. And I mean, it's beyond the as far as competitiveness and cutthroatness. The world of classical ballet is so far beyond the world of acting, you know.
Mm.
In those terms, like I feel like the acting world is much more civil, everyone's much more civil, but there's less physicality involved. So, you know, I'm sure that plays a part in it as well. But it paints a very accurate picture of what the professional ballet world is like. I transitioned at a pretty young age from that world into acting, and partly because of the fact that I felt like there was more longevity in acting, you know, on a whole,
yeah.
And that it was,
yeah,
just because it was a bit lower stress, you know, of a career choice, because the dance world is very, very high stress, and you know, it's very easy for dancers to burn out in their mid-20s, late-20s, physically. I mean, you know, to blow out their joints or what have you. So it's fascinating. I'm, you know, Darren told me, I asked him in the audition, you know, what made him choose a ballet movie? And he said his sister was really involved in dance and was a professional dancer. I believe that's what he said. She was a professional dancer. So he had a glimpse into that, and he always thought it was very, very fascinating and wanted to reveal the true, you know, the truth behind it and what really goes on. And I feel like he's accomplished exactly that.
Do you find that, obviously, acting and when you're performing with other actors and there's a give and take, there's a real collaboration there. You're all in it together. Is it
mm-hmm.
is it a different feeling in ballet?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, sometimes creatively, and you can see this on stage with really incredible dancers, that they're sort of acting off of each other and interacting. But for the most part, it's a pretty solitary experience being up there.
Mm.
You know, I mean, physically, what you're making your body do, you know, it doesn't really, if anyone's over there giving you a smile or, you know, doing some gesture movement of their own, it doesn't help you get your leg all the way up in the air and balance for 20 seconds. You know, it doesn't help. It's really your focus and your determination and your, you know, the ease on your face or the expression you're, you know, giving to the audience while doing this physically almost impossible movement is completely your own. You know, has nobody can really aid you in that moment. Whereas with acting, it's much more collaborative and sort of, you know, you feed off each other's energy, and it's individual in its subtlety. You know, what's going on internally and whatnot, but it's an art form where when you lock into those around you and you know tap into that, definitely can be a huge help in bringing out even more of that subtlety and, you know, creating more of an authentic performance. And then
mm-hmm.
dance, you know, I think it has the physicality of dance just sort of overrides so much. And the physicality is just not there in acting whatsoever. So
this might sound like a strange question, but you came from dance and theater, and then you've transitioned and done a lot of great film and television work. I'm wondering about your relationship with the camera. Was that a big learning curve, just starting out in film and television, to be comfortable in front of a camera?
Not really. I mean, the camera is not, I mean, there's so many people around on a film set behind the camera. But the camera sort of, you know, it's obviously, you know, that's the eye, so to speak, that's recording everything that's going on, and you're aware of where it is, you know, without being aware, hopefully, you know, if you know what mm-hmm. I mean, trying not to be aware of it. But there's just, I think the thing that's different about performing live versus anything that's filmed is forgetting about, is blocking out the entire crew that's around you that is not actively involved. I mean, they're all there to support your performance, but they're not performing and interacting with you. Whereas anything, you know, a ballet performance or performing live musically, you know, there's an audience. And on a film set, there's just, it's always felt to me like there's so many eyeballs watching you that are, you know, they're not immersed in that pretend moment, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not there supporting you in that way. I think that was the hardest thing for me to get past when I first started acting, was being watched so closely mm-hmm. by people that they're not the audience, but yet they're not up there with you. You know, if that makes sense, there's sort of this almost like a kind of a judgmental little barrier between you and the audience that's not there at all when you're performing live. But I'm fine with that element of it now. You just get used to that, and it becomes a comfort after a while, you know.
I'll tell you another reason why I ask, because all of Mr. Aronofsky's films, they have this terrific visceral energy to them. I mean, it's like his camera is like a source of energy. And I'm wondering, as an actress, can you feel that? I mean, could you feel the kind of style that he was going for?
Absolutely. That was one of the elements that was the most inspiring and the most pleasurable to watch, is how he would set up that camera. I mean, it really would become an entity of its own. Like, for instance, especially used in the world of dance, and you know, when he was trying to record, what would be the word, sort of embody the feeling of a certain dance movement. I mean, at one point he had the camera on just technically the things he would do with the camera. He'd have like on a bungee cord, and he was bouncing, having the cameraman bounce it along as Natalie was dancing with her feet. I mean, the camera's right by her feet on this bungee cord, which I've never seen before, bouncing along. And then at one point he had it on this sort of like a swivel thing that he would, when she was doing pirouettes, and he was getting Vincent Cassell's, like her point of view, looking at Vincent Cassell, her point of view while she was doing these, you know, turn after turn after turn after turn. So he actually had the camera doing these turns as if the camera was her. And, you know, the audience just, like, swirling. And, I mean, as someone who has executed those turns myself and knows what it's like to try to be looking at someone and doing those, he's such an amazing innovator, how he uses the camera and how he sets up shots, things I've never seen before. I mean, obviously, I've never been involved in a dance movie where you have more freedom to allow the camera to dance almost in different ways. But, He thinks up the wildest ways to set up the camera and to get shots. It's completely inspiring.
Yeah, he is absolutely one of the most innovative directors I can think of. I mean, absolutely. And you're so intimately involved in the production for so many months, and when you finally do watch the final film, the completed film, does anything about it surprise you?
There were some elements. It was much more, and perhaps this is just because, you know, I was there day in and day out, and it, you know, wasn't very scary or suspenseful, you know, on set ever. But just the suspense of the film and the level that he took it to, which he does with all of his films, which is wonderful with, you know, just, I don't want to say goriness, not gory, but just that kind of cringing edge of your seat, you know, hard to watch moments.
Yeah,
Those, you know, the abundance of those and how he put them into the script. You know, a lot of those things were not written into the original script that I read. And just that he adds so many of those things in it. Or if someone would get a real injury, you know, the camera was in there recording it. And I don't know if any of those made in the movie. I can't remember, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if there were some close-ups on different things that were actually real. Because, you know, there were obviously with dancing for 12 hours a day, a lot of blood and different things that happened for real with myself as well, you know, he just loves to capture realism. And there was one day where we were doing a dance over and over and over and over and over, and it was like the 12th hour, and I just felt the skin, you know, rip off the back of my, I felt these blisters building on the back of my, you know, in my pointe shoes. And, you know, even a professional dancer who dances every day all day long, and that's their life, they don't do the same movements all day long for 14 hours. You know, just those areas that are being used and affected, and where the pointe shoe is rubbing on the same place each time you do the same movement, it's not healthy, you know, for anyone, even the most experienced professional dancer. So anyway, I felt the skin, you know, rip off the back of my heels, and I, you know, had to stop, and he came down, and I'd been sort of, you know, gesturing to him, like, I can't go anymore, I need to stop and, like, you know, redo my pointe shoes. But he's like, just one more take, and then so finally I feel this happen, and I have a complete meltdown, and there's, you know, blood, my pointe shoes, and just thought everything's just awful, and I'm hysterical, you know, crying. But he was very sweet, and he, you know, called that evening, made sure I was okay, and, you know, everything was good. And the next day on set, he comes up to me, he's like, all right. And he could sort of think, he was obviously inspired by my very real mental breakdown. I want you to come in the scene, hysterical, and deliver the news that Winona's just been, you know, hit by the car or whatever. And I thought that was wonderful way he took to me. It was so real and so traumatic to me in the moment, and turned, you know, just improvised and added something in the script that wasn't there for the next day filming. Just added it in. It was, you know, he loves realism. He get his actors to be really going through, you know, he's not manipulative in any way, but he just loves his actors to that point of really feel, if they're supposed to be frustrated in that moment, you know, he knows the exact thing to say that makes them just go nuts. You know, it's wonderful.
And the best directors do that, I find, in that they allow the life that occurs on the set to infuse itself into the film. So it
absolutely
feels alive. It feels like a living thing, those movies.
He had us all living, you know, the soloists living in New York as if we were, you know, we were hired as local hire. And I don't think it was necessarily because that's all they could afford. I think that, you know, they could have afforded to, you know, pay for hotels and things like that, or hire, you know, local New York people. But we were all from L.A., and we were hired as local, you know, New Yorkers. So we had to fly out and find ourselves an apartment. And, you know, obviously we were getting paid, and we could afford to, you know, take cabs if we need to, or do, for the most part, you know, for 3 months, you know, you learn to take the subway, and, you know, you sort of, I think he wanted that realism of us as if we were dancers in New York, having to, you know, kind of in the dead of winter, make our way around and survive and get everywhere we need to go. And even just that, I'm sure, filtered into the general climate on set and filtered into our performances on some subtle level.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, you have a couple of projects already in the pipeline, don't you?
Yes, I do. I have a couple of very exciting things. One movie called The Speak, which I just saw the final, I think was going to be the final cut of at AFM. And it's along the lines of Paranormal Activity.
Mm.
And it's very, very scary and very suspenseful. And I think it's going to do really well out there. I know I'm not sure who's distributing it or who's releasing it theatrically in the States yet. It's going to be out early next year sometime. And
you're with Tom Sizemore on that film?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Tom Sizemore was in that film as well, and he did an amazing job. And he was, you know, he's a character, but he was a complete pleasure to work with. You know, just, you never know what he's going to do in a scene, which, or, you know, which, there's a couple moments where he's very confrontatory, you know, in a few of the scenes, and he would do something different each time, and it really achieved, you know, in me and my another one of my co-stars who was in those scenes with him, that I mean we wouldn't know which way he would be lunging toward us, you know, or it was really it achieved the necessary, you know, we came off as being, you know, realistically really intimidated because we really were a bit scared of him, but he was brilliant. I mean, he was. I learned a lot by watching him, just the ease that he slips into a character and I don't want to say improvises, but just he doesn't sort of put any boundaries on. He'll listen, you know, listens to the director and, you know, says the correct lines and all that stuff, all the technical things, but he doesn't really put any boundaries around him on what happens. I don't think he even plans ahead. I think he just lets it fly, which I think, you know, is the best way to be in the moment when you're in a scene as an actor. So it's great to watch him. So I just want to mention the other movie too, because it'll be out probably around the same time as The Speak. It's called Five Souls. And it's like a Jacob's Ladder meets Rosemary's Baby. I don't know what's up with me and all these thrillers. Maybe I need to do some comedies next before I have a nervous breakdown. But it's a beautiful film, and I play a blind girl who's so much more. I don't want to give away really what she is, but she's blind, and it's a very suspenseful and slightly paranormal movie as well. But it's just beautifully shot.
Okay, that is actress Christina Annapau. Her new movie is the eagerly anticipated Darren Aronofsky film Black Swan. It'll be open everywhere by the Christmas holiday. So when you're thinking about Oscars, Jerry, and Black Swan, what do you see?
I definitely see Natalie Portman. Now, having said that, I'm just looking at the AFI release, their movies of the year.
Right.
So we have Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids All Right, 127 Hours, The Social Network, The Town, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winner's Bone.
Well,
that's a pretty damn
True
good
Grit
list
on there. Yeah.
That's a pretty good list. Now you have seen The Fighter. Which I think looks like an incredible film, and you did like it. You are
I'm going to give my full review of it.
All right, do it right now. That's right.
I think I just got to hold out the suspense as long as possible.
Okay, we'll do that then. Okay. But all right, where do I see it? I see director, I see definitely actress, maybe the supporting actress is an interesting one because they might give it to Barbara Hershey. Because it's quite a performance.
Do you see Natalie Portman as a front runner?
Yeah.
Like many people.
Natalie Portman, I would say right now, I would even say it's James Franco is the front runner for 127 Hours, and Natalie Portman is the front runner.
You know who's
actress,
on the line.
But
you know
Jennifer
line.
Lawrence. Jennifer Lawrence, though, for Winner's Bone. She's a shoo-in. They're both shoo-ins. I mean,
she really needs a nomination for that because she's. I mean, when I think of how breathtaking she's been in the past couple of movies that she's done and what's ahead of her, I mean, she's phenomenal. I tell you why I ask about 127 Hours because Dean is on the line, and Dean actually abhors 127 Hours.
Why
so,
does it not surprise me? Let's bring him on.
Dino.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
What's up?
Can you hear me all right? I'm not out on the street. So,
I would hope you're not, because it isn't raining, catching dogs where you are.
It was the most terrible, depressing, miserable day today here in New York City, or in Brooklyn, to be more precise. And it's the capper of a very stressful week for me. But
what happened? What happened to you?
Oh, that's a long story, dude.
It's a long story, but basically I'm going to tell you in two sentences, which is I've been a very good tenant in my place. The owner of the place came back from Israel and told me in no uncertain terms that I had to be out immediately.
Oh, God.
And it's forced me to make plans to move back to Atlanta.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
You know what?
Yes.
That was like four sentences.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot better than the way I told it to you the other night. It took about 30 minutes.
Yeah, really.
So I would think though, Dean, mm-hmm. you know, you're going through this really difficult week. You go see 127 Hours, which is also about a guy that literally is between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm. This is correct.
You don't find any kind of mutual kind of inspiration.
But Dean didn't saw his arm off.
Okay, well, you know, it's been like sawing an arm off this past week, I'll tell you. So, but here's my take on 127 Hours. Of course, I go into it expecting great things, and I really want to like it. Of course, I didn't pay $13 to hate a movie. I kind of disliked it from the get-go, and I didn't even think about this when I was getting into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, I'm a big James Franco fan for a long time.
Right.
I loved him ever since Freaks and Geeks. I think he's wonderful, and I think it's great that he's in the movie and getting press for it. I think that he does a good job, you know, but I don't... There's part of me that doesn't feel like it's a... I know it's a physically demanding role, but I don't believe that the movie sketches out a character that's quite well drawn. I'll tell you, like from the beginning, I had a problem. I discovered that I had a problem with the movie because I have a personal bias against extreme sport. Not against them, but I have a belief about extreme sports enthusiasts. And here's my belief.
Okay. You get what you deserve.
My belief is that if you ride the big waves in Waikiki, if mm-hmm. you go mountain climbing, you know, like or whatever, and if you go bungee jumping or you go biking across the desert like this guy did, and go doing dangerous things inside canyons that are obviously more powerful than you are. What you're doing it for is an adrenaline rush, and that
right.
adrenaline rush comes from the fact that you're doing something that can take your life or provide or maim you or whatever. And the fact is that if you get through it, it means that that's what provides you the adrenaline rush.
Right.
Now, in order to have an adrenaline rush...
It's no different from dating, Dean.
Right. So... But in order to get this adrenaline rush, you must survive, okay? But at the same time, there must be people out there who die from these things
mm-hmm.
or who do get maimed from these things in order for the adrenaline rush to succeed. If you don't have people who die or get maimed every once in a while, then the feeling of danger that you have of conquering danger, conquering death, conquering the elements goes away. You don't get that adrenaline rush. So when
my God,
guys,
Dean, did I ask you what your thoughts on the movie
yeah,
were,
yeah,
or did, did I ask
too,
for
but
an,
he, no,
an
I
episode of Real Sports
from,
with Brian Gumbel?
I'm getting to this. So now I'm getting to the movie. So when he falls, and we all know the story. So we know the story going in. We know there's so in one way there's no dramatic tension in some ways. So
well, that's
we
true. With you could say the same about Apollo 13 for that matter too.
Well, this is true, but and then I will.
You could say the same
too.
About the Passion of the Christ if you really want to get picky.
Well, listen, I'll address.
I know
that
the ending of that one too. I mean,
I'll address that in just. Let me tell you. I'll address
okay.
that in just a second. What my problem with the movie is that above and beyond saying that I know what's going to happen is that I don't feel that the movie is very deep at all. I don't know what the movie is about. I didn't find any excitement in the story. I found the filmmaking to be repetitive. I didn't care for some stylistic touches.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few things that I liked, like for instance the showing of the passage of time while he was there by showing the planes crisscrossing and all the contrails and stuff.
Right.
I sort of liked the last 5 minutes of it with him, you know, finally, you know, getting out and everything. And there were certain touches here and there.
And in terms of defining character in our own lives, our character comes out in its truest form when we're in that kind of situation.
Yeah.
You didn't see that in this movie.
Well, maybe.
Well, I didn't really see any kind of character coming out other than the fact that he wanted to get out, and he had a lot. He had some tools, some good tools, some bad tools, to make that happen. And yes, he had to make a difficult choice. To me,
difficult choice.
Well, it's not the ultimate choice. The ultimate choice would be to, like, you know, cut your head off or something.
So if his head were caught between
you would like the movie better. So you're like, as a homage to homage to Clash of the Titans. So.
Yeah.
If his head
he'd be like, you
caught.
Know, I'm dead, but I have a choice to make here. I could.
I need
cut
to
off
interject
my head.
Here when Dean is done.
His head had gotten caught between the rock and the hard place, I would have liked the movie better because it would have been 5 minutes long.
I need to see this story about Aaron Ralston, because here is this extreme sports junkie who gets carried away one day, and he does it, literally a rock in a hard place. How does he deal with this? I do like the flashbacks in the imaginary and what he's thinking about while this is all going on. I was reminded of Into the Wild, of all movies, while watching this. I think that's where Danny Boyle's, you know, that's the first thing I thought of was the Sean Penn movie, which I think is one of the great movies of the last decade.
Okay, The Fighter. Mark Wahlberg, Christian Bale. It's a David O. Russell movie. I think it's one of the best I've seen this year. The audience loved it. I mean, the audience was cheering and crying, and it's a very good audience film as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I was inordinately impressed, if that's the word,
mm-hmm.
by the direction of David O. Russell in the film. And it does feel like a really different project for him. I mean, there's no kind of, well, at first I thought it was, I was looking at the characters and I was thinking, man, these are going to be caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they've got the tough kind of Boston accent, and they all feel like they're playing versions of, you know, the mother that nags you all the time, the sisters with the big hair that just sit around chewing gum and saying, yeah, yeah, and then, you know. but the genius of the movie is that these are extreme people, and you get into their vibe throughout the movie, and they become, and that kind of leaves your mind. They become completely natural. And they look very authentic, too. I mean, I would be willing to bet that a lot of these people that constitute his family in the film, that they're not actors. They're like the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because they look like very authentic faces. And it automatically gives an authenticity and a sense of realism to the film. The bravest thing about the film, to me, is Mark Wahlberg. Because I, you know, honestly, he shepherded this project,
mm-hmm.
And he stays in the background. He is the lead character, and in terms of screen time, he probably has the most of it. But it's Christian Bale that really takes the forefront, because he's got a very meaty role.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a one-time prize fighter, a drug addict. He's you know, completely ticky and. An extreme character, but with a lot of heart. And Mark Wahlberg, in him taking the background to Christian Bale, that mirrors the real-life situation. All the attention was always on his brother, because his brother was the most colorful and always in trouble. And so Mark Wahlberg's character, you get the same sense from him in mm-hmm. the movie. And it really is a story about these two brothers, that in spite of everything... their love and respect for one another remained, and Christian Bale is incredible. He has won the Oscar already. I can't imagine that anyone would rival that performance throughout mm-hmm. the rest of the year. He's amazing in this movie, and there's an incredible final scene, just a final clip where he's sitting on the couch with his brother, and he's talking about how proud he is of his brother, and it's so emotional. And the movie's like that. The movie's very, and everybody gives their best work. Amy
How
Adams,
about Amy Adams?
The best I've ever seen. Amy
wow,
Adams.
Wow, that's great.
Phenomenal in it.
That's saying a lot, too, because I just love her in almost everything she does. Mm-hmm. So.
And you cannot see... I mean, obviously, Christian Bale's a terrific actor, but you cannot see Batman. You cannot see any of the other roles that he's played in this character.
Right. Wow.
It does not exist. He is so fully immersed. So absolutely. Go see The Fighter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I definitely want to.
I'm incredibly excited about it, to tell you the truth. So, you know, it's been a long time since the last David O. Russell movie, so... I'm just, you know, glad that he was able to. Yeah, it's been a long time. I remember working over at Kim's Video here in the city, and he came in, and I said, when's the next movie coming out? He came in as a customer, and I waited on him. I said, when's your next movie coming out? I'm waiting for your next movie. And he says, well, I'm working on something right now, but, you know, I'm not going to talk about
his
it.
Yeah, his movie Nailed never got nailed, you know, it never came out, never got finished.
Yeah, he's had so much difficulty, and this was when I ran into him. This was, you know, like 2 years ago or something.
Right.
So it's like, so, you know, he
fair enough. He produced The Fighter.
Yeah. Oh, right, right. Which is pretty interesting too. So Aronofsky involved in two movies, big movies this year.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to say? This is totally exciting, and you know, I'm there, and you know, I fully expect to love it. Fully expect to love it. I don't think that a movie with this lineup of actors, including Melissa Leo, and actually shot in the town, you know, that it took place in and stuff. So there's going to be a lot of good verisimilitude in it, and I just don't see myself not liking this.
Melissa Leo was the one I was talking about when I talked about how I was afraid that they'd venture off into caricature. Melissa Leo was the main culprit of that at the beginning for me. I just had to get in tune with it. But there's something very heartbreaking, and I mean, I know it from personal experience how heartbreaking it is. A mother's love and her son being an eternal kind of, I mean, he's involved in drugs and you know, he's constantly in brawls and getting arrested and all this kind of stuff. And she doesn't want to believe it. And, I mean, the mother's love kind of keeps her blind to it. And there's an extraordinary scene where Mark Wahlberg confronts her and basically says, you know, this is my shot. Like I said before, I've been in the background all my life, and this is my turn. And she didn't realize that she hadn't been there for him as much as she had been there for Christian Bale. You know, she'd kind of always thought that he would take care of himself in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It works because it's about the family. I mean, it works the same reason why Godfather would work. I mean, it really is about the bonds of family.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's it.
That's good. Good review. How about the fighting sequences? Were they good?
They are good. Okay. Yeah, they are good. They have as much of an authentic feel as the rest of the. Rest of the film, but not so much so that, you know, the last Rocky film, they went a different way with it, and they shot it like it was being aired on ESPN, and so you missed the drama of the fight in a way, because you didn't have those punches that sounded like watermelons being sledgehammered, and they went a more realistic way with it. This one finds a nice balance. It's very cinematic, it's very rousing. And yet it feels like a real fight, which I watch boxing every week. And a lot of the times you're just watching people dance. And the punches, you know, the punches that really matter in a fight, very seldom you don't catch them when they first happen. They're like, that brought him down? You know, they're not these dramatic, you know, overpowering moments where you get this one defining hit that looks like the, you know, earth-shattering event. This one finds a unique way of shooting. It's all pretty closed in too. I mean, he's very closed in to the action, to the brawls that occur throughout the movie, and the chaos and the different family fighting, and it feels like you're really in the thick of it.
How does it fit in with David O. Russell's career? I mean, does it feel like it's a major departure for him in any way, or does it feel to me?
It doesn't feel as eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as his other movies, And I was going to use the word quirky, but I don't. We're tired of that word. And
we hate that
Jerry,
word.
Jerry, you especially hate that
word. It's so overused. I mean,
yeah. So eccentric.
Never use this word either. Never use the word snarky. Fuck that word. I hate that
word.
Yeah,
that's another word that I'm really... I don't even think people understand exactly what that word means exactly when they use it, but yeah.
Well,
you know,
not you, but
other people use it, don't really...
And if anyone ever says the word fuddy-duddy on the show, you're kicked off.
Yeah, really. No.
Since
God,
we're making rules. But
rigmarole can be used. Rigmarole every day.
So the movie is very closed in and very intimate whenever there's a rigmarole on screen, and but it's missing the eccentricities of his earlier work is what I'm saying. It doesn't have to exude any kind of tone or point of view that doesn't exist right there in the reality of that world.
Mm-hmm.
Because his movies do kind of have an irreality about them, them, you know. So you're right. I mean, although Flirting with Disaster was, I still think that's his best movie. But I haven't seen The Fighter yet. But
mm-hmm.
I think Flirting with Disaster is his greatest movie. Although, you know, Three Kings is obviously almost just great.
I love Spanking the Monkey. I think Spanking the Monkey is very bold.
I'm gonna use that as a soundbite.
Yeah. Well, of course you are. Of course
already
you are.
There. There. It's on tape now. So
yeah. Well, everyone knows that I like that movie a lot. So I'm not gonna deny it. So I'm honest about my hobbies too. So and don't knock them.
That's like me saying I like The Bellboy last week or last time we talked.
That's right, man. I've got two priceless sound bites for
right.
you guys. That's great.
I gotta go back.
So I was watching. I've been TiVoing a lot. So I was watching last week something on TCM. They were replaying an old Dick Cavett interview. I guess they do this every now and then.
He was great. He was a great.
Yeah. Dick Cavett has this large library of the most fascinating figures, and some on the same stage, you know, like Groucho Marx and Janis Joplin. I don't know. Somebody like extreme personalities like that on the same stage. This mm-hmm. particular episode was Alfred Hitchcock. It was like an hour and 15 minutes.
Oh,
wow.
That is the best. That is the best episode of that thing. That is the absolute best. Okay, I'm with you.
So my question of you guys is, outside of us, who is the best celebrity movie star interviewer?
Oh, I mean, I think you've already hit.
You mean alive
head,
or dead or
either one doesn't matter.
Or still working or whatever or anything. Okay.
Any yeah.
Well, I think you've hit it on the head. I think it's Dick Cavett. I mean, you look.
Well, I never said it was Dick Cavett.
No. I mean, well, you just mentioning Dick Cavett to me. I mean, you're already mentioning Dick Cavett, and
yeah,
if you had not mentioned Dick Cavett, I would have said Dick Cavett, you know, because that Hollywood movie legends box set of his stuff, which also includes people like Katharine Hepburn, he did two shows with her
mm-hmm.
and without an audience, and she insisted that he was the only person that she would talk to in that way, but she insisted on not having an audience there and so many things, and he'd really bent over backwards to appease her. And again, that's great. You know, John on that same box set. There's John Huston. I think there's you know, of course, Groucho's on it,
mm-hmm.
and Betty Davis and so many, you know, great stars, and every moment of every piece is a gem. Every moment of every piece.
Yeah,
he
did a great job.
Fantastic.
So,
and then there's a Rock Legends thing, a box set, too, and also the John Lennon Yoko Ono box set. So
mm-hmm.
all of that stuff, if you take all of that stuff in, yeah, I mean, Dick Cavett, definitely.
Yeah, Dick Cavett and Carson, but I guess today, I mean, I think we could all... At least the most in-depth interviews today is Charlie Rose.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I might go with maybe somebody like, you know, to think outside the box for a second, maybe somebody like, you know, Terry Gross.
Yeah, I was just going to say
NPR.
Terry Gross on Fresh Air would be the other, definitely, you're absolutely right. Probably the best interviewer today, I think. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, there's three interviewers that I like that I watch or listen to regularly. There is Terry Gross.
Mm-hmm.
There is, for someone that knows their stuff and asks questions based on a real knowledge of what he's talking about, because these other people, they're good interviewers. They're very warm and give a, you know, there's a back and forth there. But they don't have the knowledge base to actually ask the questions that I like to hear asked.
Right.
Elvis Mitchell.
Oh, yeah, Elvis Mitchell's good. Mm-hmm.
I like listening to his interview.
Who does he comment for?
Well, he's all over the place. He's all over the place. He's on KCRW.
So he's NPR. Okay, yeah.
If you look up that on the web, KCRW, he has a show called The Treatment,
mm-hmm.
where he interviews people every week, and then he does a lot of events. He's the moderator interviewer for a lot of events.
Well, Charlie Rose.
Charlie Rose strikes me. The reason why I like Charlie Rose is that he's amazingly intelligent.
Yeah.
And insatiably curious. He absolutely wants to know how you do what you do, and he's particularly fascinated in filmmakers.
Right.
So I always like his interviews. I was watching. Also, why I ask is because I was watching Larry King Monday night, who had Al Pacino on as a guest,
mm-hmm.
and. He doesn't strike me as someone that shows up prepared, which is fine. I mean, I don't really prepare either, which really shows. But he
No, that's not true at all.
But plus he's been doing it for like 40 years or however long it's been. So I mean he has it down. But
right,
I don't think anyone really credits him as any kind of great journalist. He's in a position to cover breaking stories, to speak to these amazing people, as was Cavett.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see Larry King as a great conversationalist. And what I like in interviews is a feeling of a conversation taking.
Right.
Yeah. For me, Larry King is sort of a populist kind of guy is not really in it to like show how smart he is. I think
he has said that. He has said that before.
So it shows, and I'm not saying that in a bad way.
I think that
he tries to get to another side of people that's possibly the less bookish side of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the more personal side of it. I mean, you know, you see that interview that he did with Brando, where they kissed at the end of it, and everything like that. I mean, that just shows that thing right there just shows you the whole thing. You know, that's the guy he is. You know, that's also Brando.
So yes. I mean, that's all Brando
mm-hmm.
that made that moment memorable. There wasn't a moment from his interview.
Right.
That he provided that was necessarily memorable to me. I can't remember really a question that was asked or a response that was unique enough that I committed it to memory.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, only that moment is really something, you know. I mean,
and the thing that made Cavett's show fascinating were the obviously with any talk show were the personalities that he brought on. I don't necessarily see that he led them in any kind of direction that revealed anything new about a lot of these people. I haven't seen every Cavett interview. I've seen anything that's on YouTube, you know, like 20, 25, you know, a couple of dozen of them.
Mm-hmm.
The memorable moments are the ones that the guest creates, which I guess is as it should be. The host should just facilitate an environment that allows that to happen.
Yeah, I think that's his strength, and I think it's also his strength that I think he knows his stuff, too. And
mm-hmm.
it's not just that he knows the stuff that he's talking about, but he's able to make connections between a large variety of subject matters while speaking about one specific subject matter. So,
right.
So, for instance, if he's talking to someone, he can, you know, about their career or whatever, he can pull a quote out from, you know, Tennyson or something like that and relate it to.
That's true.
And build a question around that quote, an intelligent question that probably no one else would ask. And so that's interesting too. But and also Cabot's strength is also his. I think he has a pretty great wit. I mean, you know,
yeah, he does.
Having been a comedy writer and so forth, and so that comes through. And also, let's just be honest, just his ability to get those people on stage, like you said,
right.
That's a talent in and of itself. I mean, that must have taken so much work to even just take the Katharine Hepburn thing, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Alfred Hitchcock interview is superb. I love it. I think that might be the crowning moment for me in the box set, at least. You know, of course, you know, haven't watched all of the shows, in the box sets, I've watched all of those, and I just found the Hitchcock interview to be just delightful, and I loved finding out, for instance, that Hitchcock was really into puns, like he thought puns were the highest form of literature, and I love that. I love a good pun, and I don't apologize for making any puns. So it's like. I agree, and but anyway, it was great, you know, and but that's a very interesting question you asked.
Well, thank you. Well, that's because I'm a great interviewer.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
What about Merv Griffin?
Well, that's true. I do remember Merv Griffin when I was a kid. Yeah,
yeah. Remember Orson Welles is on every other week.
You must have had free wine in the green room or something.
I'm thinking now about the SCTV.
Oh, that was great,
Merv,
special edition.
Yeah, with Orson Welles in there. Like,
yeah, they made Devil's Tower out of stovetop stuffing in the
80s. I'm glad you remember the HAL 9000 as a guest.
Oh yeah, that was great.
And Carson was amazing.
Oh yeah, Carson was really. I mean, Carson and Cabot and this time period were really the kings, and I know that you have so many talk show hosts now, though, just so many. It's it's
but
hard.
Nobody...
You bring up a good point, though. I mean, it's about Charlie Rose, Terry Gross, and Elvis Mitchell. They all know their stuff, and they bring something to that.
And plus, Charlie Rose is never going to be in a position too where he has to interview Paris Hilton.
No, of course not.
And Larry King, I mean, he's on a news station. And he wants to get ratings.
That
he wants to
ratings.
Interview the hot people. Yeah,
desperately.
Yeah. Right. So Paris Hilton, he'll talk to Paris Hilton and for an hour, and then spend the last 30 minutes talking to Gorbachev. You know, so there is something special about his abilities, absolutely, without a doubt.
And he's a personality in and of itself, kind of,
you know,
obviously a character. So. But I have to say, I don't watch Larry King ever. And, in fact, I sort of make fun of Larry King. You remember Larry King doing the column for USA Today back in the 80s, where he would do a column where it'd be like a series of, like, unconnected thoughts, like, I think red buttons should be declared a national treasure. I sure like pizza, don't you? It's yummy. And all stuff like that, you know, it's like, what?
What are you talking about, Larry? I mean, what are you on?
You got a whole column here, and it's just all of these little statements, you know. Like, I think Electric Boogaloo is the best movie of the year. It's so fun. You know what? Come on. Yeah.
Another sound clip. here's a list. Here's a top 10 list from God knows where. Website called Scene Stealers with Eric and JD. Eric and JD, if you're out there, mad props.
Mad
here's
props,
their
baby.
List. Here's their list of the top 10 overlooked, most overlooked films from the past 5 years.
Okay.
Hmm.
Let's just do it. Let's go for it.
Number 10, 2008, Ghost Town.
Okay.
That thing with Ricky Gervais?
Yeah. All right, I could see where you... It's a good movie. I don't know if overlooked, but okay, I mean...
That
it's entertaining.
The invention of lying is better than that movie.
Well, the invention of lying is another, but I mean they're both good. I mean they're both, but they're both ignored. I mean he's, you know. But all right, let's go. Can we go further,
go
Dean? Can we hear the rest?
Number 9, Zathura. John Favreau.
Wow, these. Okay.
What is that one?
It's okay, but all right, let's go. Keep
Zathura.
Going.
Is that the unofficial sequel to Jumanji, or is it officially a sequel to Jumanji?
Well, I know they're written by based on books by the same guy. I didn't realize that they were like actually. God, these kids got
to
stay away from the board game or whatever.
I don't know either. I overlooked that title.
We'll overlook it completely now.
I've completely overlooked that movie myself. So okay.
Number 8, I'm sure Jerry, you'll agree. The Lookout.
Yeah. That okay. Now I could definitely see. Yeah. Definitely.
I agree. That was a good movie. Very good movie.
Number 7, I kind of agree. The Upside of Anger.
Yes,
that
definitely.
That was one I didn't see. I didn't see that.
Yeah, definitely.
You need to see that.
Yeah, definitely.
If you need to get that, I can put you on mute.
No, that's cool. Someone else got it. As long as they didn't pick up while we're on the air, though, that's all I care about.
Number 6, I agree. The New World.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a movie that gets better with every viewing. I mean,
best movie of the last decade for me.
Mm.
Wow, that is a bold statement.
Them's fighting words.
Them is, but it's a movie that gets better with each viewing. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous movie. Good. Number 5 is The Matador.
Yeah, another movie that's very entertaining that people did not give enough props to.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And Pierce Brosnan is superb in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is a good movie. That's very good.
Best that he's ever been.
I would give you the top 4, but my computer is frozen.
Man, what a way to coitus interruptus here.
I know. Number 3. Wow, number 3. This is interesting.
Wait,
the Black Dahlia.
Skip 4?
No.
Did you skip 4?
I did skip 4. Yeah, I was going straight. All right,
but Black Dahlia. I mean, hell. Wow, Black Dahlia.
I hated that movie. Despised that movie. Right.
Let's pretend like Black Dahlia is number 4.
Okay.
The real number 4, but it will count it as our number 3. Jerry, here you go. The Fountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm liking this. Some of these titles are very good, definitely.
The Fountain was the best movie of that year.
Okay, number 2. Speed Racer.
Oh, these guys must be smoking crack. That's where
No way.
Was.
No way.
Speed Racer is just so.
No way.
I just don't. All right. Well, now I got it. What's number 1?
They say about Speed Racer, to dismiss one of the most inventive movies in recent memory as a candy-colored assault on the senses is missing the point completely. This groundbreaking offering was unfairly bashed like no other movie that year. Like most films that were ahead of their time, though, I'm sure that it will have its day. Nothing else. Was it as invigorating from that
okay.
year?
Okay, I mean, to each their own. I mean,
so what would your like number 1 overlooked movie of the past 5 or so years be?
Happening?
No, I'm joking. I'm joking. The most overlooked. Go to Dean first. I'm sure Dean has a more immediate answer than I do.
Well,
you think it's
127
hours, Dean? You think that's what it is?
It hasn't been overlooked. That's the only problem. This movie that I'm going to mention it was nominated for a couple of Oscars, not as many as it should have been, but it has been picked. You know, it did make the list of 100 greatest movies of the decade in Film Comment, but I still don't think I would put it in. The category with The New World is a movie that deserves a bigger audience, and that's The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Yeah.
I think that, in fact, I just watched it last night again. I can't believe how many times I've watched it, this 2-hour and 40-minute movie.
It's a great film.
And every time I watch that movie, I see something different in it. It never bores me, not for 1 second. And I find everything about it fascinating. So that would be my number 1.
I think that's a good, that's very, and we're talking the last 5 years. I'd have to maybe go with Where the Wild Things Are. Because I don't think that got, that really didn't get the recognition or anything.
Which I just saw the other night, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I like that movie too, quite a bit.
Yeah, that's the first one I'm going with. I could think of others, but that's the first one I'll go with.
It's weird, though, because when you're talking about Overlooked, it you know, it's hard to do. It takes a little bit of research for me because I'd have to go back and look at my, you know, I made on Filmic Ability, I made a list of all of the great movies that came out in every year of the 2000s and all the movies that I liked in order, and then the movies that were, you know, of note in every year that you know, were part of the best offerings. So I really wish that I could go online and take a look at that to get a really truly overlooked movie that got like the Wild Things, Where the Wild Things Are, that didn't get any kind of award recognition or any kind of recognition as being the best of the year. Oh, here's another choice, though. Here's a big choice. This would be a movie that I would choose as maybe the most overlooked, and that's The Fall by Tarsem Singh.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I think the fact that that movie didn't even get a cinematography nomination, much less a nomination for its lead actress, who was something like 6 years old at the time and was definitely coerced into giving a great performance, maybe coerced in a not-so-moral way, but even Lee Pace in the male lead, and also just the complete sweep. I mean, this movie was shot in 27 different countries, and there was no CGI-ing things in this movie. Tarsem Singh actually went and shot in 27 different countries and got some of the most amazing images I've seen in the past decade. That was my favorite movie of that year, and it got no recognition. I might make that my most overlooked movie, because it got no awards recognition. When I would tell people that I thought it was the best movie of the year, I would get sneezed at. And it didn't make any list of the best of the decade. So.
Well, I've made no secret of the most overlooked film for me of the past 5 years.
Yeah.
Mine would be another assassination movie.
Ah, the assassination of Richard Nixon.
Right.
That's a good
choice.
Very
interesting.
Or
yeah,
that
no
press, no writing,
no attention
whatsoever.
Came and went very quickly.
I tell people that movie exists. They don't even realize that movie exists.
Mm-hmm. It came out and fell through the cracks. There was something about the release date on that was weird or something.
Yeah, it fell through the cracks.
Just that year.
That's what the movie's about. It's about someone that fell through the cracks, you know. So I guess it's fitting in a way.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, that performance by Sean Penn is a lot better than this performance in Milk, I think.
It's a towering performance, yeah.
Yeah. He really needs, like we said so many times on the show, I mean, that's his Travis Bickle. He really needs some kind of recognition. The makers of that movie need some recognition of their accomplishment.
I agree.
But that's just me. That's just me. We can't save the world entirely with a show. I mean, we try, but we can't.
Well, at least we can hopefully, you know, people who are listening who probably haven't seen probably the large majority. Of course, movie geeks are listening, so maybe they have seen it. But hopefully, that's what film criticism is about, or film commentary is about pointing people to the great things that they might not know of.
Do you think Eyes Wide Shut is overlooked or underappreciated?
Absolutely. Oh, well, both, but then again, in the bringing back film comment in the wrap up of the best movies of the 90s that came out in February of 2000 for them, Eyes Wide Shut did make the list and was on a lot of the polled critics list as one of the best of the decade. But yeah, you're right. Eyes Wide Shut is, especially with the average movie-going public, is incredibly overlooked and and actually quite hated, and unjustly so.
Ebert put it like as Ebert. No, Scorsese put it as like his number two of the decade, or something like that. Number two or three.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, like, definitely of the, and especially of Kubrick's oeuvre, I don't know my opinion of why it was widely disliked is because we live in a time where there's a lot of hype, you know, connected to movies, and this particular movie was so done in such secrecy and covered up so well that people had these, for 2 years, were concocting these wild notions of what the movie might be.
Right.
And when they went and watched the movie, and it wasn't what they were expecting, they were expecting a sexy, erotic thriller. And with lots of, you know, they were expecting to see, you know, Tom and Nicole get it on screen.
Right.
And this was not that movie. This was, I mean, it's thrilling, and it, there are moments in it that I would say are erotic, but it's not the movie that people wanted, and it just wasn't what they were expecting. And these days, people go to see movies. That's why trailers give away the whole movie, is because people want to know exactly what they're getting when they get in, and if they're surprised in any way, shape, or form, they are mad.
Yeah, and that's not good. It is a journey, and you know it better have some unexpected stops and twists and turns. But people really don't want that. It seems they really do want this. It's like, I hate this. People really. It's good to be specialized. If you're a doctor, it's good to have a specialty. I don't need that specialty in my art, though. I think it's very important to have a lot of unexpected things happen, because if it is just predictable, well, what the hell's the point, you know? If there's, you know, it shouldn't be. I mean, I'm so glad that when I think of a movie in the trailer, I have this idea of what it's going to be. If it's really good, it's not going to be that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think is important. And I think you're absolutely right. People do walk in. They want this thing, this vision of themselves, basically. It's almost like this narcissism, if you will. They want this reflection of their own life, you know, of everything they want. Well, I don't see really the joy in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would liken it to going and buying a product. You go out, you buy a box of Tide detergent. You expect that detergent to clean your clothes. If it doesn't clean your clothes, then you're mad.
Right.
Same thing. That's the way I think a lot of people look at the product of movies, and that is, you know, like I said.
Right on the head.
And Eyes Wide Shut did not clean their clothes.
No, it didn't.
So they were
made as a product.
I think they were mad that it didn't stain them.
Well, you talk about a very important thing, and with it, it's sad that people think like that, but look at Fight Club. People, it was marketed as an action film, and when it wasn't what that was, people were very upset with that film when it came out originally. It was not an action film, and far from it. So it is. It's partly marketing, but people sometimes don't know how to market things. But I would just think, we have a Kubrick film. That enough is joy for some of us, you know. And his last one, unfortunately. So.
Well, it is.
But very, very fitting that that's his last one.
Yeah.
I mean, and very fitting that that's the last line in his last film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that last line.
It's a great.
I was so touched by that last line in some ways. Like,
I bet you were.
Amused and touched. I was, well, you know, when I was sitting watching Eyes Wide Shut, you know, I went to see it at a special screening that no one could get into. I used my TNT connection to get into it. And this was after I was working with TNT. And I was, of course, Kubrick was gone, and I knew this was the last moment. That I was going to see a new Kubrick movie. So the experience, in fact, I'm talking about it now, and actually my voice is shaking a little bit. The experience of watching it was quite moving in a lot of ways, being a lifelong Kubrick fan, just sitting there and just knowing that every frame that was passing was going to be the last new frame that I was going to see of Kubrick's movies. Mm-hmm. And that particular last line was just something that really blew me away. And you know, it was totally fitting last line for that story. That is exactly what they need.
Well,
there's
something interesting that's coming up, too. And I'll leave on this before we play our closing interview. His films comment on one another.
Mm-hmm.
His films are very self-contained in a way. A lot of movies you can picture the characters going on and living their lives after the end of the film. In the end of a Kubrick film, you can imagine that if they did that, they just go back to the beginning of that film and repeat it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And there's stuff like I said in the first episode. Like Strange Love ends with nuclear annihilation, and then Mankind Begins Again at the beginning of his next mm-hmm. film. The last line in Eyes Wide Shut, and then do we get the Star Child after that? I mean, mm-hmm. you can connect all of his movies, even down to like Mickey Mouse, Danny watching Mickey Mouse or
right.
something, and The Shining, and then it's referred to it in Full Metal Jacket at the closing
you're right.
song.
Wow, I never thought about that, but you're totally right.
There's a very kind of cyclical aspect to Kubrick's work where he is commenting on the idea of doubles. He has doubles in a lot of his movies. There's an interesting double in Eyes Wide Shut between Thomas Gibson and Tom Cruise, and there's something really interesting about Thomas Gibson in that movie too.
Mm-hmm.
And speculation as to why he was chosen, and how it has something to do with Dharma and Greg, and the name Dharma, and how that relates to the Hindu chant that was originally playing during the orgy that they cut out for fear of insulting that culture. It's an endless well.
Amazing. Then you look at The Shining, for instance, which is filled with mirrors. I mean,
mm-hmm.
filled with mirror reflections in that film. So
he's got a thing for toilets in his film.
Yeah,
he does.
Film.
There's always a toilet scene. And also, I wanted to comment again on go back to what you were saying about like the movies commenting on each other. Then you've got the very last shot of Clockwork Orange, which has Alex rolling in the sand with a nude woman while people in Victorian costumes are clapping along the sides. And then the next movie is Barry Lyndon with people in, Victorian, I don't know.
And there's also that inexplicable, like, 17th century Victorian bedroom that he's in at the end of 2001.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, which is also mirrored in the scene in Eyes Wide Shut
right.
where Tom Cruise goes over to Marie Richardson's apartment to attend to the dead father, a dead old man who's lying in a bed very much like the bed in 2001, very much in a room that's lit differently than the one in 2001, but it is a comment on that. So, you're right. It's all.
Yeah, you're absolutely.
We're jumping down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are.
It's easy to do when you start talking about Kubrick. It's very easy to do.
Yeah, we'll be back Wednesday night. Speaking of interesting guests, Wednesday night, we have the childhood friend of John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy, a notorious serial killer. His childhood friend will be on. It's the release of a new film on DVD from Anchor Bay Entertainment called Dear Mr. Gacy.
Wow.
Starring William Forsythe. So Forsythe was on years ago.
Yeah, he was on for the Paul Schrader show.
What does this gentleman who's going to be on, what is his actual connection with the movie? Did he write something that the movie is based on?
He wrote a book called Johnny and Me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did not conduct the interview. I had Aaron do it, our correspondent, because I was on another interview. But so I'm anxious to hear it. I haven't played it yet.
That'll be fascinating.
So I don't know what show we'll build around that on Wednesday night. But
we'll have to talk a little bit about serial killers.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, oh, that'll be good.
Yeah.
Good.
talk about your all-time favorite serial killer, Dean. There you go.
But I used to be obsessed with serial killers when
I
was in high school.
Me too. Me too. Serial killers and mass murderers. I can believe
that of you.
Well, I had to stop it because I determined that it was blackening my soul, so I just had to stop it.
Blackening my soul. Okay.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Now you're officially freaking us out, Dean.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, can we play the interview, Jamie?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Okay.
We will be back Wednesday night. Hopefully, Dean will have gotten some help by then, and we will and we'll talk at you guys then. I'll see you guys later, man.
All right. Good night, everyone.
All right.
Let me introduce the interview.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's a good idea. Sorry about that.
I'm so taken aback by what Dean had to say.
I know. Really. Yeah.
There's a new film. It's called Complacent. It's a great family drama, and it is about what the title would imply, people that are complacent with their lives and kind of deteriorating from the inside. It concerns two close sisters, so it's a family drama. It is available now on Netflix and iTunes exclusively. It'll be available on DVD early next year. We have with us today the composer and the producer of the film, Mr. Corey Jackson, and so we always love to talk to film composition with various composers. So this is another installment of this great ongoing series we have speaking about the art of film composition with Mr. Corey Jackson. First of all, tell me about your passion for music and where that came from.
I've had a passion for it ever since I was a kid. Apparently, my mom said that when I was in the car seat, when the radio came on, I would just start not banging my head, but something of that nature. And so it's been there forever. And I fell in love with music when I first saw Kiss, I think, in the 70s, and just kind of,
it's great,
you know, aspired to be a guitarist until I was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
And then when I went to college, I said, let's try composing. Basically, I was a songwriter since I was 15 years old,
mm-hmm.
And when I went to the University of Oklahoma, they didn't have any kind of guitar or songwriting program at that time, and they said, well, we have a composition program, you want to try that? And I said, well, sure, that's got to be like songwriting, and it wasn't, but oh man, did it open up a world to me. And my first teacher was Michael Hennigan, who for a time was Jerry Goldsmith's brother-in-law. I went down the academic path. I got my bachelor's and I got my master's in composition. And then I went to Paris and studied at a composition program there for 2 summers. That's when I decided, I said, okay, I'm either going to get my doctorate and I'm going academia, or the year before, I just happened to submit my application to the USC program for film scoring for motion pictures and television. And I was put on the short list for the following year. So I'm sitting there after the Paris program going, okay, what are you going to do with your life now? So, I mean, you've got to write. That's obvious. You can't get away from it. Or how do you make a living at this? So, you know, I'm going to do something real easy and go to Los Angeles and make a living in film scoring. So that's how film scoring came about, because I always loved music. I've always loved movies. And it just came out, it just seemed like the logical thing to do.
What is it about film composition that excites you in a way that's unique to film composition as opposed to these other forms of music, whether it's being a guitarist in a band or any kind of other musician?
I wasn't sure. I think initially it was that, you know, you get to be part of the movies, the thing that you love, you know. It's mm-hmm. that excitement about it. But I don't think it really, really clicked for me until I saw a piece of film without music and production sound. I mean, it was just production sound without, you know, something up on screen that's finished and it's mixed and it sounds great. And then I come out here and I see these films that are just, when you see it stripped down and it's, you know, when you're looking at it to compose it, it's sometimes very hard to watch because mm-hmm. it's just so strange not to have all that. The realism's not there. and realism for movies anyway, because as you know in life, you know, a soundtrack doesn't necessarily follow us around. But when I saw, it's like one of my first projects at USC, and I saw what music could do to the scene, and I said, man, I think I made it better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I made it work. I mean, not necessarily better, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, okay, I think maybe we're on the right track now. And it's I can't tell you exactly why, but it's those intangibles of music that what it does to you emotionally.
Yeah.
When you feel it, because in a movie you really feel it, not so much as hear it. It's all us geeks that go out and buy the soundtracks later that hear the music.
Me included.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm one of those geeks.
You do it to relive that intangible that you felt in the theater. You know,
right?
And I don't know what that feeling is. I have no idea what the word for that is. Fantasy, imagination. I don't know. But I think that's why we all love it.
Well, so you're exactly right. I mean, music in all forms, it's the quickest way to the heart. It's something you feel and can't articulate. So I'm sure the same.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you break in?
My second semester at SC, I started working for Joseph Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Joe's a great TV composer, son of John Williams and former lead singer of Toto. And I was helping him out with his rig and moving stuff around and configuring his systems, because in a former life I was really good with computers. And also at the same time, I got hired by Chris Leonards.
Mm.
And I was basically assisting both those guys while still in school. So when I got out, I had some experience and still work for Chris to this day. It's been almost 8.5, 9 years or so, I think.
How important is the relationship with the communication and the relationship with the director in the process? I would think that it's obviously instrumental.
Oh yeah, it's pretty important. I mean, that's the whole key right there, is trying to, you're not necessarily all the time putting your vision of the score to screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a lot of collaboration, and talking about music is like talking to someone in another language. It's that understanding between the two where you can kind of create that magic, and where he goes, bang, that's it, that's my movie. And then you go, okay, I can write this, and you get together, and hopefully you can communicate. And I know you've heard stories where people can't. It turns out, you know, there's all kinds of stories about,
mm-hmm.
you know, crazy things happening, but It's very difficult, so you got to spend a lot of time working that side of things out.
Do you have a preference on when you come in on a movie? Do you work best at kind of a concept phase, or do you have to have footage in front of you to really know the feel of what you need to accomplish?
I like reading scripts, but I don't get the score from a script personally. Mm-hmm. My mind's eye, I get it from the lighting, the shots, the editing, all that stuff. That's where I start to hear it. So, I mean, if it was possible nowadays, I would like to be in on Final Cut. But since Final Cut doesn't really exist until the day of the opening,
right,
whatever it is. So, I mean, I love hearing it. I love going to set and, you know, talking to people and that type of thing. That's just fun. But
mm-hmm.
when it comes to my real work and, you know, the nitty-gritty, bring me in at the end when you're happy. When you're as happy as you can be with your picture, then I think I'm most, that's when I become an asset, I think, personally speaking.
Is there always that, well, I guess it would be ideally, is there always kind of an aha moment when you do find the musical voice of the film? I mean, hopefully there's that moment with every project you do.
Yeah, sometimes, and sometimes your aha moments don't agree with one another, in a sense that you may write something that you think, okay, this is the one, this is what they're going to love, and then they'll hear some kind of secondary phrase or bit of transition, and they'll say, no, that's my movie.
Mm.
And, okay, you know, it happens to everybody. I heard an interview with Goldsmith about, I think it was Basic Instinct.
Mm.
I think the same thing happened to James Newton Howard with Signs. It was another cue, a secondary cue. They said, no, that's my theme. So, you know, everyone's different, and you just go with the flow.
You know, and being a composer, like everyone that works on a film, you are an assistant storyteller. So when you view a film, what is your goal? Are you wanting to feel the motivation of the characters and get an obvious sense of the feel of the film? Or?
It usually takes me 4 or 5 watches to start getting my feel for the film. But I'm not exactly sure what I'm listening for. Probably mood more than anything, or what I'm searching for.
Hmm.
I think just capturing the mood of it.
You've worked with Stephen Monroe a couple of times, haven't you?
Oh, I think 7 or 8 now. I think we're on. So
okay, more than a couple of times. So,
yeah.
So tell me what it is about that. What is it about that collaboration that clicks for you guys?
I think we understand each other's process pretty intimately. That it's kind of becoming secondary. I remember the first job we did together, I think, was It Waits for Sci-Fi Channel. It was a Stephen Cannell production.
Mm.
And I don't know, just from that first thing, I mean, it was a you know, hell-bent for leather, you know, get done in 2.5 week type score. And under that kind of pressure, we just really clicked. And, you know, we didn't stress each other out, none of that type of stuff. We just, you know, what's the best thing for this movie that we're doing right now? So, I don't know, it just really worked out with us.
Do you ever reference the feeling of other scores or from other films, or do you try to avoid that so you don't run the risk of making something derivative of anyone else's work?
No, he always uses temp scores. And,
okay.
Or he'll say, listen to this. And I think why people use that as such a tool, and this is how I interpret it. You listen to this piece of music, this is the mood I want for the scene. And so what I try to take is the essence of the piece and nothing else. For one thing, it's illegal. But but I think that's why so many storytellers, directors, producers, what have you, that's why the temp score is what it is today. I mean, I've never been on I've been on one film that didn't have a temp score.
Hmm.
But it's so part, I mean, I, you know, it can become a burden if people are way too married to it.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, let me ask you about the latest two collaborations you've had with Mr. Monroe. Complacent, and I Spit on Your Grave, correct? Those are very different films. So
yeah, quite a bit.
Tell me the particular challenges of each.
They are, you know, they're really not so much different in approach, in a sense that your goal is the same for each one, is to find the voice of the film, dramatically move it along as best as you possibly can. And so in that sense, on the most basic level, it's actually, you know, it's the same. Complacent, you know, is a group of friends, no CGI, nothing like that. It's, you know, it's basically an Altman film. Lots of dialogue and a very subtle, completely piano score until the very end when something happens, and then we start getting some cellos and stuff in. So, and it's a very complacent score as well. It doesn't move much. And then A Spit was, you know, a lot of ambience, a lot of sound designish type stuff mixed in with what I considered a throwback to the 70s film score, which I love. The original I Spit on Your Grave did not have a score, so that was actually kind of nice for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, you know, create its own thing.
Is there a genre that you really want to tackle? Do you have a dream project or a dream genre?
If there was a film that I wished I would have scored, I would say it'd be something like WALL-E.
Mm.
I do animation with Bill Plimpton.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of animation. But I guess something on that scale where you can open it up, and it's such a beautiful story. You know, I guess bigger movies is what I'm saying.
Now, I always ask this question of any composer we have on. Could you name 3 to 5 of your essential film scores? If you were to recommend the essential ones in your collection, which ones would they be?
I would say Korngold's, anything by Korngold, Robin Hood, Seawolf, Double Recall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Amazing, amazing. You can listen to that like concert music. It's like Bartok. Signs by James Newton Howard. Hellbound by Chris Young.
Mm.
Absolutely brilliant.
What's your favorite Herman?
I was just deciding, is it going to be North by Northwest, or is it going to be The Man Who Knew Too Much?
Mm.
You
could choose both. I mean, this isn't a
test. I think so.
Because you do what you do, can you watch a film and not be super sensitive to the scoring in it? Can you lose yourself in a film like the rest of us can?
Not so much anymore. If it's a perfect score and a perfect move, what I consider to be at least close to perfect,
mm-hmm.
If I go away from it not listening to the music, I go, okay, everything worked for that one.
Mm.
And two movies that recently did that for me was the latest Harry Potter. Desplat knocked it out
yeah.
of the park, I thought.
Yeah.
And How to Train Your Dragon.
Mm.
That was great. That was brilliant on all levels. Foreign film-wise, I'd say The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was great.
Mm-hmm.
And Let the Right One In, I thought was brilliant, too. See, I don't even remember that score, but the movie had such an impact, dramatically, it was spot on.